This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka. Coming up, community outrage in Papua New Guinea as a video of police beating members of the public goes viral.
Obviously, it was very gruesome and overly excessive. What I think should be done is that the police should control how they act.
We look at a program to cut down drowning deaths in the Western Pacific.
I would single out Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands as being some of the Pacific Island countries that have really begun to look at this, you know, as one of their leading killers.
And what's the time? Confusion in Fiji as mobile devices jump 1 hour ahead, 1 week ahead of the start of daylight savings.
Sunday for us was a new day because we had to rush around most of the mid-morning.
More on those stories coming up. Authorities in Papua New Guinea have arrested two people after a video surfaced on social media showing police officers beating three men, triggering community outrage. The acting police commissioner, David Manning, has vowed to bring justice for the victims. But many community members say that doesn't go far enough. With this just the latest case of alleged police brutality, some people now say they want a complete overhaul of the policing system. Our reporter, Jordan Fennell, has been following the story. Jordan, what can you tell us about this video?
The video appears to have been shot from across the street from where the incident happened. It's a really grainy video, but you see three men lying on the ground. They're wearing shorts and t-shirts, and then there are two other men in blue shirts, which appear to have police insignia on the shoulders, and they're also wearing long pants and holding what appear to be guns. They hit the men on the ground with the butt of their guns. They also yell at them, kick them, and stomp on them. This is all happening near a white car that does not have police signage on it and is unclear who it belongs to. At various points in the video, the men in the blue shirts open the car doors and look around through the car. Then about a third of the way through the video, another car pulls up without police insignia and a new group of men get out. These men are wearing darker clothes and what appear to be boots. They begin assaulting the men on the ground as well. They hit the first car with bats and sticks, breaking the back window, and then they hit the men.
So, Jordan, we now know that two police officers have since been arrested, and this event took place in September. What else are police saying about this incident?
The acting police commissioner, David Manning, has made a statement saying that the video angered him and he vowed to investigate and bring those responsible to justice. He also said that the video showed a clear case of excessive use of force as the men on the ground did not resist but continued to be assaulted by police.
Jordan, this isn't the first time we've seen cases of alleged police brutality in Papua New Guinea. What's the reaction been like from the community now that this video has gone viral?
Yeah, there's been a huge outcry from community members. The video has gone viral on social media and many are calling for the police to do something about this. I spoke with Port Moresby resident Stan Nilian, who watched the video on Monday night, and he says he wants to see a complete overhaul of the policing system.
Obviously, it was very gruesome and overly excessive. What I think should be done is that the police should control how they act, because they are there to enforce the law. You know, the law is for everybody. We have our rights. The police should work within the boundaries or the code of conduct. You know, there's a way to apprehend a criminal. There's no need for excessive violence. You know, the person has been apprehended.
Port Moresby resident Stan Nilian. An Australian woman is facing a difficult battle to bring her young son back to Australia after he went to Papua New Guinea temporarily to live with his father several years ago. The 9-year-old boy was born in Australia and is an Australian citizen, but has been living in PNG's capital, Port Moresby, for the last 4 years with his Papua New Guinean father, who the mother claims has refused to send him back to Australia. She says the Australian government has told her it cannot help because PNG is not a signatory to an international convention that can help return children taken overseas by another parent. Liam Fox reports.
Charmaine Backhouse's voice breaks when she talks about her son, Isaiah.
The innocence of my son has been taken away, and that's what breaks my heart. I had to leave him.
She last saw him in August this year when she travelled to Port Moresby to celebrate his 9th birthday. Isaiah has been living in Port Moresby since 2015 with his father, prominent doctor Duncan Dobunaba, who's the chief anaesthetist at PNG's health department. That was when his parents' seven-year relationship ended, and Ms. Backhouse says they mutually agreed he would temporarily live with his father in Port Moresby while she moved from Brisbane to Broome in Western Australia. She says it was never intended to be a permanent situation, but there is no formal arrangement in place with respect to custody of Isaiah.
Ever since then, I have been over twice. I've kept in contact. I've always begged him to bring him back, and his last famous words is, "Yes, I will. I'll bring him over," and nothing ever eventuated.
Isaiah was born in Brisbane, is an Australian citizen, and has an Australian passport. When he went to stay with his father in 2015, he entered PNG on a dependent visa. That visa expired in April 2016. Dr. Dobunaba said via text message that Ms. Backhouse has not been truthful and that there are always two sides to a story. He said it's not entirely true that he has refused to allow Isaiah to travel to Australia, but declined to comment further. Ms. Backhouse has approached the Australian government for help to bring Isaiah back, but she was told there's little it can do because PNG is not a signatory to what's known as the Hague Convention on the Civil Aspects of International Abduction. That convention provides a process for a child to be returned to their country of habitual residence for custody issues to be dealt with. International family law expert Dr. Danielle Bozen says it can be extremely difficult for a parent to get a child back from a country that has not signed up to the convention.
So essentially they'll have to engage with that country's legal process. This can be logistically and also financially difficult. For example, finding a suitable qualified lawyer and also navigating a foreign legal system that can be informed by quite a different culture and potentially different ideas about what's in a child's best interest.
The Attorney General's Department said it can't comment on specific cases and recommends parents seek legal advice in the concerned country about what options are available. In a statement, it said financial assistance may be available to cover legal costs. After several failed attempts, Ms. Backhouse has now engaged a local lawyer.
I'm extremely nervous because it's their country. It's their country politics that scare me. And because he's such a high-ranking doctor over there and well-known, he's very well-connected. My main goal is for the safety and the well-being of my son.
She's also started an online petition to try and pressure Dr. Dobunaba to send Isaiah back voluntarily.
Liam Fox reporting. The Cook Islands Ministry of Health has raised concerns about a banned Australian nutritionist and naturopath who has recently been teaching in the country. Earlier in the year, Barbara O'Neill held workshops in Rarotonga, and she's reportedly due back in the country next year to visit the Outer Islands. But she was recently banned from practicing for life in Australia by the New South Wales Healthcare Complaints Commission after giving potentially harmful advice to vulnerable patients. Our reporter, Jordan Fennell, with more.
Now, Joshua has agreed for me to wrap him. Even after doing those compresses on his chest yesterday.
On her website, Barbara O'Neill promotes herself as a qualified naturopath and nutritionist. She travels the world giving lectures and has hundreds of thousands of views on YouTube of her seminars and tutorials.
It is being filmed and we have seen some incredible turnarounds with doing this treatment.
But in October, the New South Wales Healthcare Complaints Commission found that she did not have any certified qualifications and barred her for life from practising in Australia.
My name is Michael O'Neill. I'm the husband of Barbara O'Neill and I'd like to give you a little update on Barbara's case. Barbara has been given a life ban by the HCCC and is not allowed to teach. She's not allowed to give health lectures or anything like that.
The Healthcare Commission found that she had been telling people the debunked theory that cancer was a fungus.
But the beauty of this cancer treatment is there are no side effects. Your hair won't fall out and your fingernails won't go black.
And could be cured using baking soda.
Recipe is 2 kilos of sodium bicarbonate.
And this has caused concern in the Cook Islands community where Barbara O'Neill has recently hosted workshops and seminars. Kate Walker is an Australian who frequently travels to Cook Islands and says it alarms her that a banned naturopath is being promoted in the country.
I think that there should be a high level of concern that these people who have been banned in other countries nearby, Australia, these people tend to go to other places. They move onwards and they, you know, continue spruiking this non-scientific garbage, which potentially, it's very, very dangerous and it should be stopped.
And it's an issue that hits close to home for Kate. Her own mother is buried in a cemetery in Rarotonga after travelling to Cook Islands in the 70s to receive treatment from Milan Brajk, the infamous Czechoslovakian refugee and so-called cancer therapist who had been found to be practising without a licence.
People can't just come out with some supposed cancer cure or whatever, because these people are vulnerable and they're grasping at straws, and it's really, you know, it's just giving people false hope.
Dr. Josephine Herman is the Cook Islands Secretary of Health and says that the Ministry of Health is investigating how Barbara O'Neill was able to teach in the country.
We are highly concerned and we are in the process of contacting the organisers. Sometimes there's many people that want to come and help the Cook Islands, as in other countries around the world, and often things like this are bypassed in terms of processes. And our community don't always understand the need to follow good process to make sure any health practitioner here in the Cook Islands understands the rules and regulations that govern our work.
But not everyone is as concerned. Barbara O'Neill has a strong following in the Cook Islands, and Cheryl Masters, a Cook Islands resident, attended one of the workshops earlier this year.
There was a successful turnout, but it was just a small group of ladies without any budgeting or money, doing it all free of charge, voluntarily.
She claims all Barbara is offering is a healthy lifestyle.
I don't see suggesting people to eat a healthy diet as a medicine. It's just a lifestyle change. And it's what you hear, what everybody is promoting these days is just eat more fruits and vegetables. And
Mrs. O'Neill is reportedly slated to be back in the country early next year, but Dr. Josephine says if it is found that Miss O'Neill's qualifications aren't up to scratch, she will be barred from entering the country.
We will be firm on the decision if it's found that she has no legal association with a recognised regulatory body.
That was Cook Island Secretary of Health Dr. Josephine Harmon speaking with our reporter Jordan Fennell. And the ABC has reached out to Barbara O'Neill, but we've yet to get a response. They often say change takes time, so is it possible to significantly alter the culture of a business in just 2 years? New research out from Solomon Islands has found that a program that's been rolled out in 15 of the country's largest companies has seen dramatic changes, helping to make the workplaces safer, especially for women. Those behind the initiative, known as Waka Mere, say having more women in leadership positions is largely the reason why. Catherine Grau reports.
In terms of confidence and being, you know, step out and leading the team, I should say. Being a Solomon Island national myself in a senior level, I don't have the basic...
Lynn Farroto is a senior bank manager in Solomon Islands, one of the few females working at such a level.
But I have been attending in-house training, but it doesn't broaden my knowledge in terms of becoming, you know, a leader or what are the leadership skills that are there.
The lack of confidence and adequate skills amongst working women in Solomon Islands is a common story. It's something similar to what Atanasi Atta has seen too during various times in her career.
Women are defaulting to readily, you know, being the coffee makers, the tea, the food servers at big, significant meetings. You look at the social and the whole structure behind it.
She's the Chief Executive Officer of the Solomon Islands Chamber of Commerce, which is one of the partners on the Waka Mere program. It means she works.
That's the value of this program. Just that role modelling, having 15 big companies put their hand up and being willing to do that.
Those 15 companies have more than 6,000 employees between them. 2 years before the Waka Mere program began, they found that 25% of the female workers felt unsafe at work. Amy Lewinstra from the IFC, that's the International Finance Corporation, which has also led the program, explains some of the reasons why.
We know overall in Solomon Islands, there is considerably fewer women in formal work than there are men. And so most all women are working in places where they're dominated by men, not just because there's more men than women in most of the workplaces, but also the men are in leadership positions. And for the most part, men are also in certain technical roles that tend to pay better and in positions just on the whole that have a bit more power. So that can be part of it. There's also, I mean, of course, a history here in Solomon Islands of the tensions and some of that post-conflict kind of culture and issues play out in the workplace. And most importantly, 2 out of every 3 women in Solomon Islands is likely to have been affected directly by violence in her lifetime. So all of those things, you know, they play out at workplaces as much as they play out in communities.
But in new research, they've found the situation has improved dramatically.
To be honest, I was surprised. I mean, delighted, of course, but really surprised that you could see such a cultural shift in just 2 years of work.
The key, both Amy Lewinstra and Atanasi Atta believe, has been the multifaceted approach of the Waka Mary program.
Working at those different levels, I can see now why this finding. Yeah, so it's not really a surprise, but it's good. It's a very positive outcome.
Dozens of women have been put through leadership training that's seen 80% of them promoted or given broader responsibilities in their current jobs.
The leadership training was one of the most, I think, transformational because you're unleashing the creativity and the confidence of women that previously really didn't have that confidence or that ability to speak out or no one was listening and they didn't think they could speak.
Companies have also introduced things like anti-bullying and domestic violence policies. And most have also trained a select number of staff, so they're better equipped to deal with survivors of domestic violence they may come across in the workplace. They're all changes that IFC's Amy Lewinstra says are also benefiting the male employees.
We talk about bullying a lot, and that often affects more men than women. And what we're talking about is just being respectful and supportive of employees, whether they're men or women.
This latest research was carried out by the IFC itself, but Amy Lewinstra maintains their findings are of international standard.
We don't have a purely randomized sample, and we can't guarantee that it's fully representative, but we had a really strong response rate. And we did a lot of qualitative work as well, lots of interviews. We've talked a lot with the leaders and leaders at different levels in the company, and we feel very strongly that there's been significant change.
Amy Lewinstra from the IFC, the International Finance Corporation, ending that report from Catherine Grau. The Pacific Islands are often seen as places with idyllic lagoons and safe places to splash around in the sunshine. The truth isn't quite so simple, though, with more than half of the world's drownings happening in the Western Pacific region, which includes Pacific countries, but also Asian nations such as Vietnam, Cambodia, and Australia. As Nick Fogarty reports, it's a fact that Pacific governments and NGOs are waking up to, with a new program in Niue that's aimed at safeguarding children from disaster.
Pacific Island nations, as well as many in Asia, are places that are sometimes more water than land. Archipelagos, where people can spend large amounts of time travelling between islands to visit family and work. Children grow up around the water and are aware of it from a very young age. Yet still 60% of the world's drownings happen in what the World Health Organization designates as the Western Pacific and Southeast Asian regions. Dr. David Meddings coordinates the WHO's Global Work on Drowning and says the severity of the situation in these regions has forced the group's researchers to sharpen their focus even more.
And it's one of the reasons why WHO is currently undertaking a bi-regional status report on drowning within the Western Pacific region and the Southeast Asia region. It's the first time we've ever done that, and we have focused on those two regions because of the very high rates of drowning.
The WHO's research shows that the unique way of life in the Pacific Islands, with lots of inter-island travel on unseaworthy boats, is a big contributor to high drowning rates. 95 people died in a ferry disaster in Kiribati in January last year, and David Meddings says PNG provides a similar example of dangerous inter-island crossings.
A very high percentage of these inter-island voyages are taking place on 6 to 7 meter dinghies that are equipped with typically a single outboard motor and might hold anywhere from 20 to 30 individuals inside without life jackets. And they are making voyages in some cases of up to 400 kilometres.
The biggest affected group, though, when it comes to drowning are children, especially those under the age of 5, with children in the Pacific being mobile from an early age and often unsupervised around water. Authorities are awake to these sorts of water risks over in Niue, where Swimming New Zealand has been tasked with running a program for primary school students. Swim teacher Chris Morgan is helping to run the program in Niue,
and says authorities realised that a lack of water safety knowledge among fishermen was being passed on to their children.
They are fine in the water for very short periods of time. Most of the younger kids, say up to year four, can go under and float, but not for a good period of time. So we're concentrating on developing their skills so that they are really, really confident and competent.
Chris Morgan says she's there to teach the teachers, who will then go back to their home communities to teach more kids themselves. At this stage, there are no plans to expand this particular program to other Pacific nations, but there have been inquiries.
If other islands wanted it, they've got to be committed to learning it and delivering it themselves, because it's not about us coming and doing it for them, it's about us giving them the skills to do it themselves.
World Health Organization drowning expert David Meddings says it's encouraging to see Pacific governments and NGOs are moving to address the high rates of drowning.
I would single out Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands as being some of the Pacific Island countries that have really begun to look at this, you know, as one of their leading killers of their in their population. These are cultures that are working, getting education, traveling on water all of the time, and they've begun to appreciate that you need to sort of engage with how safe that relation is with the water and do what you can to improve that.
David Meddings says that engagement with drowning risks will need to continue as climate change worsens, with warming sea temperatures sending fishermen further out into the open ocean and extreme weather events leading to more and more catastrophic floods.
Nick Fogarty reporting. The switch over to the start of daylight savings can be confusing at the best of times. But in Fiji, when smartphones automatically updated their clocks to an hour ahead, a week early, there was all kinds of chaos. Kelvin Anthony reports.
Daylight saving time adds extra hours of daylight during the summer season, while making the days shorter during the winter months. But who came up with
it's a topic that's divided opinion all over the world. While for some, an added hour of sunshine is welcome for extracurricular activities, others loathe having to wake up an hour earlier in the mornings. But in Fiji on the weekend, many people were left asking questions because of daylight saving. David Matavesi is from Nasinu, one of the most populated suburbs outside the capital, Suva.
Yesterday we got up at our usual time, which would have been 7 a.m. But unfortunately, we were oblivious to the fact that the timings had changed on all devices.
Mr. Matavesi is among hundreds of Fijians who were left confused about whether daylight savings had begun. Even though there were alerts disseminated through local media and social media platforms, he says they had not effectively reached the people.
Majority of individuals may have missed out on the information, so I believe that's where the confusion was. So the Sunday for us was a new day, because we had to rush around most of the mid-morning trying to get lunch together and then have our usual rest before we head out for church.
Others took to social media to express their frustrations. Some people spoke about getting to work an hour earlier. Others complained about major examinations being held around the country this week. A lot of the blame was pushed on to the mobile network providers for the disruptions. However, both major mobile networks in Fiji released statements to clarify their position. They said it wasn't an issue they had much control over. Some mobile handsets are configured to take times from software updates instead of the local network. In a statement to Pacific Beat, Satish Narayan, Digicel Fiji's sponsorship manager, said,
"This happens almost every year as the Fiji government changes the daylight savings time start every year. Some of the handset softwares does not update, which causes the misalignment."
Himmat Lodia, president of the Fiji Retailers Association, says they haven't received any complaints from members. Mr. Lodia says people have gotten used to the idea of daylight savings and it's no longer an issue for the business community. Fiji's Department of Information released a statement on the weekend in an attempt to clarify the situation. Praveen Bala, the employment minister, confirmed people will need to wind their clocks forward 1 hour at 2 a.m. from this Sunday, 10th November. Meanwhile, Nasinu resident David Matavesi says daylight savings is an added struggle on top of what already is a hectic, challenging and busy lifestyle for Fijian parents. Mr. Matavesi says it isn't a concept that he supports.
My suggestion would be just to carry on with how things are at the moment. I wouldn't play with time. That's what I wouldn't do.
Fiji's daylight savings period will end on 12 January next year.
Kelvin Anthony ending that report. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.